FAAC setback in New York slot auctions, whether flight plan computer systems fail, more rocket racing news, and Zoom goes thud. All that as we welcome back Rob Mark to discuss labor news across the industry in this Labor Day edition of the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Airplane Geeks. This is episode 13. As always, with me is Max Flight. Max, how are you?
I'm good, Court. How are you?
I'm doing well, and I suppose I should probably introduce myself. The person with Max Flight, I guess, is Courtney Miller. And our guest this week, once again, we thought he did such a great job that we brought back Rob Mark. He's the CEO of Comavia and editor of the syndicated blog Jetwine.com. Rob, thanks for coming back.
Ooh, thank you so much for having me back. I mean, and it's Labor Day, too. Wow, what a good day to do this.
It is Labor Day, so what we're going to do is kind of follow a labor-ish theme today, I guess. That was more on accident than planning. At least we look like we know what we're doing, right?
Well, we sound like we know what we're doing since we can't see each other anyway.
And again, we got a whole slew of news, so what do you guys say we jump right into them?
Let's launch, guys.
Okay, first story, it's probably our most interesting story, comes from the Economic Times. And if you can believe it, Airbus to extend A380 to accommodate 1,000 passengers. Airbus SAS, the world's largest plane maker, is considering an extended 1,000-passenger version of the A380 aircraft. The A380, the world's largest commercial aircraft, even in its current form, can carry 555 passengers. It entered service in October last year after a two-year delay. Galois, is that how you pronounce the guy's name?
Yes.
Galois.
Who is the CEO of EADS, said Airbus had planned the extended version right from the start. A decision on building the huge aircraft is to be taken only in 2010. This is all kind of coming at the behest of Lufthansa and I guess Air France, KLM are both interested in this. 1,000 passengers.
That's a big airplane.
And I know, Rob, that you had kind of mentioned something on the likelihood of Airbus being able to push development on this, but
I laugh in the face of danger. I think the chances of that happening are pretty slim. I don't think anybody even believes that Airbus is ever going to turn a profit on the A380 basic. With all the problems they've had over the years and the demand being what it is, I guess that but a stretch version. I think it makes for good press, but I don't think it does much more than that.
Makes for good podcasting.
Yes, it does. It does indeed. I mean, but imagine 1,000. Well, actually, but you know what's really interesting though is that when you're on an airplane, I mean, think about even flying on a 747. I mean, which is a fairly large, complex cabin. You don't know what else is around you. Once, you know, the bulkheads go together and you can see back 50, 80 people, and you don't know if there are two bulkheads past you or 10 or 10 below you. And so as far as the passenger's concerned, it doesn't really make a whole lot of difference. But I think something that you both mentioned before is that these days you always wonder, oh my gosh, if one of those should ever go awry somewhere. Oh my Lord, 1,000 folks in one fell swoop. It's a frightening thought. I mean, it's always a frightening thought when any airplane goes down, but 1,000 people at one time. Whew.
Yeah, it's got to be in the back of your mind.
And the thing that kind of crossed my mind when I first read it, after the utter shock and disbelief of it, was one of the main issues with the A380 right now is that most of the airports are having to upgrade their taxiways and runways and jet bridges to be able to accept it. What happens if they stretch this thing that much further? Is Airbus going to go back and say, oh, by the way, you know, you need to do it again? They're going to say very diplomatically, bite me.
Well, I wouldn't be surprised if they'd had those discussions initially. I mean, I have no doubt that Airbus didn't consider a stretch version or versions when they designed the aircraft. I mean, I think that's pretty standard in large commercial aircraft. So I don't know. I wouldn't be surprised if they had had those discussions with the airports, and there was some kind of an understanding about if there would be additional facility requirements or not. But that's different than making a commercial decision to go ahead and actually build the thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and the infrastructure issue these days, of course, at least in the United States, is a huge problem. I mean, we can't even get people to spend the money for runways, let alone upgrading for just a few airplanes. I mean, and let's face it, how many of them are going to actually? It'll be interesting to see how many of them actually make it here to the U.S. on a regular basis.
I'd be very interested to see what kind of range you're going to be able to get out of an aircraft configured for 1,000 passengers. I mean, effectively, they're doubling their payload, their passenger payload, plus bags, cargo, whatever.
Well, the engines probably won't be the same, though.
No, they won't. But again, anytime you do that, typically the range of an aircraft suffers, right? Look at the 747 domestic. I'm curious to see if they're going to double the fuel capacity as well, because like you said, the new engines probably will be included with that, which are going to have to be much more powerful, hence the higher fuel burn. You know, are they going to be able to increase the fuel capacity in proportion to their payload? And, you know, are we going to see another, what was that, Max? The Dassault Mercure with a 400-mile range?
Right.
Ooh, wow. You guys are way older than I thought you were.
No, just Max. I'm not.
Just Max.
but typically, too, the airplanes that have those incredible load factors don't tend to be super long-range airplanes, too. I mean, we may find those kinds of airplanes, you know, flying around in Asia and those areas where they don't seem to mind loading 500, 600, 800 people into a cabin for a 2,000-mile flight or something.
Right. The Hajj comes to mind. I'm sure there would be tons of flights into Saudi Arabia. Anywhere you see a 747 domestic now, which I think Japan, maybe China. And I don't think China has any domestics, but it seems like that would be a place for them, or maybe India. But, Rob, you mentioned this earlier. Let's see how the current A380 does, because there's a ton of open questions about that before we can seriously start talking about the economics of a 1,000 passenger version. In fact, heck, why don't we just talk about a 2,000 passenger version? It seems just as likely at this point.
Yeah, I think that it makes for good press, and let's face it, Airbus needs a little good press right now. In fact, so do most of the aircraft manufacturers. I mean, I think that when they look at their order books from even 6 months ago, most people are believing that a lot of those orders that are on the books are going to evaporate. I've heard numbers as high as 25% of those numbers or those orders could disappear. And boy, when you're building something as expensive as a 380 and probably making almost no money on it anyway, right. You can't afford to be losing too many of those.
Now, of course, there's always the talk about the A380 building, Airbus building a freighter version of the A380, and that's been put on hold. I've been told that there are some serious setbacks with being able to use the upper deck to carry any cargo, specifically any loaders that can get it up there or an internal system. And that was really the true promising function for this aircraft. And as far as I'm aware, there hasn't been any progress. Yeah. And again, of course, it's all kind of prefaced by the news that surrounded the 747 when it first came out. And it's tough to ignore that we're saying the same things that all the naysayers did about the 747 back then. So I don't know. That's history kind of doesn't lend to it, but I'll tell you, common sense just doesn't seem to surround that airplane.
Well, and there's always the danger, I think, when you grow older, is that you start to realize if you're self-aware at all, then are you really starting to sound like your father, or are you actually smarter than your dad was when they made those kinds of statements?
Wow, you and Max must be really self-aware.
Oh, man, I am so self-aware. I just, you don't even want to know.
Okay, stumbling into the next story then. A follow-up on the FAA slot auctions that they were going to conduct in New York. The FAA delays first slot auction for Newark. The Federal Aviation Administration's plan for slot auctions at Newark Airport got stuck at the gate on Thursday. A victory for airlines who have fiercely opposed government sales of landing rights in some of the nation's busiest airports. The airlines and the Port Authority have argued that Congress never authorized the FAA to sell those takeoff and landing rights at the three airports. The Port Authority had threatened to block flights that used the auction slots. The FAA retaliated this week by saying the airports risked losing federal funding if they blocked the flights. So this seems to be the latest and greatest soap opera that we get to talk about here on Airplane Geeks.
Oh, I think this is so cool. This is just like being at home when you're a kid, and if you don't do what your dad says, he says, well, you're not getting your allowance.
But here, dad blinked, didn't he?
Dad blinked. You're right. Oh, I'll tell you, when I saw that FAA lawyer, I'll bet he got a very unkind phone call from Bobby Sergel at FAA and also from Mary Peters at DOT. My guess is they were not happy about that decision at all. But then FAA, let's face it, FAA does not like being told no to. They don't like hearing those words.
Well, neither does the Port Authority.
No, but I tell you, when I saw that the Port Authority and the Air Transport Association were both going to jump on FAA about this one, I thought this is going to be really, really interesting. Because let's face it, with only two slots, it's not the number of slots that are in question here. It's the principle of the thing. They don't want that camel's head or nose under the tent. And I think this is going to be bloody. I'm sure this isn't over yet by any stretch of the imagination. We just have a temporary lull. But I have a feeling this one's going to get really interesting.
Agreed. Yeah, these are only two slots. And I believe the article says that there are 1,200 daily slots at Newark. So you're right. I mean, it really pales in comparison to a day's worth of slots. However, it does set the precedence.
Yeah, and that's also what FAA is worried about.
Right, absolutely. And, you know, is it just me, or has the FAA gotten a little more aggressive in the past, say, 6 to 8 months? You know, it seems like with things like this, that, you know, the slot auctions in New York, the aircraft grounding at Southwest and American, plus all the other airlines with the MD-80s, is this a fundamental shift in FAA policy, or is this just kind of isolated incidents that are giving us a lot to talk about on podcasts?
Well, I personally think that when FAA changed its mandate however many years ago that was and took out the support of, I forgot, Max, maybe you know, the phrase was actually wasn't support of aviation, to help aviation thrive, or I can't think of the precise language, but they did take on a very, very much more sky cop kind of attitude than I thought. And I think this has only gotten worse.
Well, then they had the accusations of cozying up to the airline or airlines recently, and maybe this is a way for them to show that they really are in control and in charge and they know what they're doing. I don't know.
Well, and that is a perfect segue, Max. I don't want to answer the question, but I can offer some hints into what it seems to be the case as far as the FAA knowing what they're doing by reading this article from the Associated Press. FAA outage reveals odd computing practices. This is from the flight plan computer system that failed this week. By using computing practices that would be considered poor in credit card networks or power plant operators, the FAA was vulnerable to a problem caused when new software was loaded at the Atlanta Center that distributes flight plans. Because the FAA relies on just two computing systems, one in Atlanta and one in Salt Lake City, to handle that chore for the entire nation, the software glitch all but sank the system Tuesday. Salt Lake Center remained up and served as a backup, but it became overloaded by information coming from airlines. More than 600 flights were delayed from Atlanta all the way to Boston and Chicago. Whoops.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, this is kind of basic stuff, or at least it would, you know, it would seem to be. I mean, you know, companies install or upgrade mission-critical software all the time, and, you know, the IT professionals will tell you that, you know, there's some good standard process for ensuring that that works. It works the first time, and you don't have issues like this. Now, we don't know exactly, or I don't know exactly what went wrong here, but it seems like something that you ought to be able to get right the first time.
Well, you know what the problem really was, is that this is all Windows-based software. If they'd had three Mac PowerBook Pros linked together, they would have probably been in great shape.
I beg to differ on that one. They should have been Linux systems.
That's right. Oh, Linux, man. All right. No, and it's funny, when I look back, it wasn't, I forgot the exact date, but it wasn't that long ago that FAA, 12 or 14 years, which seems like a long time to some, but not to me, I guess, but they retired their last piece of vacuum tube hardware. And, FAA, honestly, has never been technologically savvy to people inside and outside the agency. So, I mean, when I saw this story, I thought it didn't seem like a terribly big surprise to me.
Moving on to some news about rockets. Easy. The Rocket Racing League conducts successful inaugural test flights of Armadillo space-powered rocket racer. You remember what we did talk about this several episodes ago, but this from MarketWatch of the Wall Street Journal. The Rocket Racing League today announced the successful results of the first three test flights of the Bridenstine DKNY rocket racer, now equipped with liquid oxygen alcohol engines manufactured by Armadillo Aerospace. These test flights mark an important milestone for the league, occurring just weeks after the first public demonstration flights of the rocket racer at the 2008 Oshkosh Air Venture. Each of the three test flights averaged about 10 minutes, with a top speed of 190 knots. Additional test flights of the rocket racer equipped with the Armadillo rocket engine will be conducted in the coming weeks. A first demonstration race is tentatively scheduled for the 2008 Reno Air Races this September, pending approval from the FAA.
Wouldn't you just love to be the CEO of Armadillo Aerospace?
I don't get the Armadillo. I mean, why name your rocket engine after an animal that basically rolls into a ball and hides?
It is kind of ironic, isn't it?
It is kind of ironic. Maybe it's the security of it.
Yeah, I guess I was thinking of the fact that nothing can basically get to an armadillo. I mean, it's pretty strong. But I have to tell you, when I saw this particular model was not the one they were running at Oshkosh, I don't believe, but the one that they did have at Air Venture was just really neat. It was just raw horsepower. It was like watching somebody fly a military fighter in afterburner the entire time. I mean, it was just, you could hear it from miles away.
Rob, what was the reaction of the other folks at Oshkosh to that?
Of course, we were the folks I was with were not at the flight line when this started, and so we heard, the roar of the rocket, and at first we thought it was a fighter of some kind. I know, I was with some folks from Cirrus, and we were looking around, and I said, "Gee, what the heck was that?" And the other lady looked, she said, "I don't know why I see that." I see that Verees flying, because it was in the attached to the body of a Verees, and I said, "Well, it can't be that little thing making all that noise." And then we realized that it was, and so everybody, it really caught everybody's attention. I don't know that everyone completely understood what it was or what it was trying to do. But you know what, Oshkosh, people just react to noise. I mean, we're like lemmings. We react to noise and movement, and so it was kind of fun. But he was up there for about 10 minutes, and we talked about this a little earlier. It was just rocket on, rocket off, rocket on, rocket off. And it was just this huge flame shooting out the back end of this airplane.
Yeah, and I think they've really kind of found the magic mixture of aviation entertainment, and that's a lot of fire coming out the back end of an airplane that looks bright and pretty, not that the airplane's on fire, and noise. What I found disappointing about this is it had a top speed of only 190 knots.
My guess is the only reason it was only 190 is it was still early in the testing. I don't think they were, because you're not going to win any races at 190 knots.
I would hope not. I do want to see some speed with this, but this, I think, Max, when we talked about this news last time when it came out, we were skeptical that they were going to be able to get this done. I'm slightly surprised that they're on schedule, at least it seems to be.
It does, and it's looking pretty positive for this right now. I think everybody's hoping for success. That's, if it's something as exciting as this, you want it to be successful, so we all hope it is.
Yeah, and I think, again, what we saw up at AirVenture, the rocket engine attached to the VRE's, my guess is that that's going to change, because if they'd have gone full bore, they'd have probably torn the wings off that VRE's.
Yeah, that could be. Okay, moving on to some airline news. This from the Associated Press. Passengers stranded after Zoom planes grounded. Hundreds of Zoom Airlines passengers were stranded Thursday in Canada and the UK after cash-strapped Canadian airline suddenly canceled all of its flights after creditors took action to get money owed to them. Zoom said the economic downturn and unprecedented rise in the price of aviation fuel made it impossible, blah, 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 blah. Now, where have we heard this before? Good God. Zoom, and I wasn't very familiar with this airline until, of course, they shut down, ironically. But they were flying across the Atlantic. They had 3 767-300ERs and 2 757-200s, so a fleet of only 5 aircraft.
What did you expect when you buy a ticket on an airline called Zoom? No, I'm sorry, that's not fair. I mean,
it was either that or wee.
Yeah, I yeah. know. Okay, this is, but that's okay. It's Labor Day, so we, on a holiday, you can be a little more flip. I mean, I actually, what's really a shame about this is that they even with oil down somewhat, these guys weren't able to hang on. But you can't. It's simple economics. You have to be able to meet your expenses and make a decent profit, or you're going to go out of business. And except in the United States, where somehow we always manage to figure out a way to keep our airlines alive.
Yeah, we subsidize them. It's called the bankruptcy process.
Yeah, it's true.
Well, let me ask you this, Rob. Do transatlantic carriers based in Europe have an advantage over American-based carriers because of the exchange rate?
I guess the question I would ask is, are the costs any different? And at least from what I would think economically, I mean, with the exchange rate, what it is, the pure cost of fuel should be somewhat less to those folks. But still, when you throw it into the big hopper, it's a huge portion of their cost portfolio. And, again, there's so many other variables there. We don't know what they're paying their employees and all the other, how much do they have to pay back to the stockholders? And who knows? But, again, it still comes down to the same thing. At the end of the day, did you make any money carrying all these people in these big airplanes? If you didn't, it's only a matter of time.
Right, absolutely. And I think what I'm getting at, not only you kind of spoke to the cost aspect of, if you're in Europe, you are going to be paying more of your employees at the higher rate due to the exchange rate. But I guess the question that I was getting at, where do European-based carriers attract by nature more European-based round-trip customers than do American-based? Are people in Europe more likely to go to a European-based airline to buy those tickets, whereas the American carriers are stuck with people less likely to the exchange rate?
Well, it's interesting, and I guess I often wonder, too, if it's just an exchange rate issue or if it is simply a familiarity issue as well, a marketing issue. I mean, I don't think we ever hear about anyone marketing Zoom Airlines down here in the States enough that people would say, wow, you know, I want to get up to, you know, Toronto or wherever they were flying from to catch hold of a Zoom flight to go to Europe. And I wonder if it's the same way in Europe that when those flights were leaving from London Gatwick, were they mostly UK residents, or were you getting people coming from, you know, Paris saying, let's go to, let's, I don't know. It's a very interesting question. But of course, if you look here in the United States, how many people that are U.S. citizens travel on foreign carriers? I mean, because it's kind of the same thing. I wonder, exchange rate or not, I guess I just wonder what the percentages would look like, because most people tend to fly on U.S. carriers out of here.
Okay, moving on to the next article. This from the Kentucky Post, and it's near and dear to my heart here locally in Cincinnati. That's Delta pulls Comair flights out of Concourse C. Delta has confirmed it's pulling all of its Comair flights out of Concourse C at the Cincinnati Northern Kentucky International Airport. Concourse C was built in 1994, and it was built solely for a regional airline operation. It was upgraded several times throughout the history. And I think what's so kind of telling about this closure is that that was the first dedicated regional airline terminal and one of the largest. And for Delta to pull out of that just kind of alludes to the direction of the RJs and the regional airlines. But they're going to be moving everything into the larger concourses, rather, concourses A and B with jet bridges. So this is a huge blow to Comair, of which Concourse C was kind of their pride and joy. It was their identity. And it kind of spells the direction that Delta is looking to go in their Cincinnati hub, especially with the merger. And I think the same can be applied to Memphis for Northwest as well.
No, I'm just interested in kind of the you know, merger implications, or maybe it's the other way around. Is you know, this a move that's supportive of the direction that the merger is intending to go?
Oh, I think that's absolutely true. I mean, you know, of course, people have been saying that for ages, that mergers do not help anyone except the airlines, that they reduce competition. I mean, the number of flights and services. I mean, but let's face it, that's the point of the merger,
right?
is to not have all kinds of extra baggage. Sorry, no pun intended there. But, you know, no, without all this extra baggage that you need to pay for that you can't use. So I think anyone that thinks that the United, or I'm sorry, the United, yeah, United, wish you could find a merger partner.
yeah.
The Delta Northwest merger. I mean, anyone that thinks that services are not going to be cut is absolutely naive. And it is a shame, though, because if you've traveled through Cincinnati, I mean, any of the Comair people have always said, well, you know, we've got our own terminal here. And, you know, and it was pretty cool. But, however, you know, it's a different world today. And listen, they'll be lucky if they even keep Comair. I mean, they'd like to get rid of them, but who wants to buy them?
Okay, moving on into some labor-related news. This from the StarTelegram.com: American Airlines employees eye British Air Alliance warily. As American Airlines, British Airways, and Iberia work to forge a transatlantic alliance, one group is eyeing the proposed hookup warily. Airline employees. They have good reason to be worried, there's no question about it, said Richard Gritta, a finance professor at the University of Portland who studies airline economics. The airlines are going to try to cut costs, cut duplicated services, anything to save money. The agreement complies with all aspects of our labor agreement, says Tammy McLellan, a spokesperson for American. To compete and win on a world stage, we must be able to offer customers a level of seamless global connectivity that is impossible for any single airline to deliver on its own. So there you kind of get both sides of the story from each, from, you know, the union side as well as the company side. And this is kind of a merger without a merger, right?
Oh, I think it's probably as close as it's going to come. I mean, but you know, the American and British Airways have tried this a couple of different times before and been thumped on the nose, saying that, you know, this isn't going to happen. But of course, the economics are different now. But I understand why the employees are. It goes back to what we just said about the other story. I mean, the only people that really benefit from a merger are the airlines, and that's typically hopefully the stockholders, but also, you know, senior management whose bonuses are tied to profitability. But again, customers and employees, they usually kind of get the short end.
Yeah, and that's definitely going to be the case here, where, you know, duplicated service means less employees, or removing duplicated service means fewer employees required to fly the routes, and then fewer seats for people to compete for on a fair basis. So the fares are going to go up, and you're going to have less people employed to work those routes. This almost seems like it's a compromise for the Open Skies Agreement. Like, maybe they want to give the legacy carriers something to chew on, when by legacy I mean American, British Airways and Iberia. But ironically, we're seeing the exact opposite of what we thought we would see with the Open Skies.
Yeah, it is really interesting. And I, of course, like I said, this is a different world. I mean, there were so many things in the past that airlines could cope with, but the one unknown is fuel. That's the one thing they cannot negotiate down. They can't deal with it like they do labor issues or catering or baggage handling, and that has just thrown such a monkey wrench into their plans that I think most of these carriers are willing to try almost anything. And I think what you said before, Kurt, was edit that part out. you know, it is, I completely lost my train of thought. I have no idea what the heck I was going to say. So over to you, Max.
Well, I was, yeah, thanks. You know, maybe I'm the odd man out in this, in this discussion, but I mean, I really do favor more consolidation in the industry, and whether that's by, you know, alliances or mergers. You know, I think if the companies that participate in this industry are not healthy, then none of the above matters. You know, it doesn't serve the stockholders, it doesn't serve the employees, it doesn't serve the flying public if the companies become weak and even go out of business, as we've certainly seen, you know, many examples of. I mean, if Zoom could have merged with someone and you know, kept flying, wouldn't that have been a better situation? You know, there's an example right there. Now, I don't know that was, you know, even an option, but you know, I just don't look at these things as necessarily being, you know, net negative to the consumer. I think that, you know, having healthy airlines is important, and that's as, you know, as a member of the flying public, that's what I want to see.
Well, actually, I agree with you, and I think that the difference is that there is the short term benefit and or you know, problem that we face, and the fact that there's going to be less competition and perhaps higher fares. But in the long run, you're absolutely right. It's what we've been talking about all morning here, is that if the airlines can't make any money at what they're doing, they're going to follow the path of Zoom and so many others that have gone before them. And honestly, I would rather pay a higher fare. Oh, God, I can't believe what I'm saying.
I know, it's hard to say, isn't it?
But it is. You know, I would rather see them be healthy and at least have some access to air travel than none at all. And so your point is very well taken, Max. I mean, without some of these consolidations happening, I don't think anybody's going to be able to save some of these carriers, and they're going to go down anyway.
Well, shame on you two for bringing a rational argument during Labor Day.
I know. Yeah. Well, most people don't. You know, in fact, a shameless plug coming here. We had a really nice post on jetwine.com today about labor, only because so few people have really grown up It's not that people are anti-organized labor. Most people today really don't have an awful lot of experience. They've almost few have really ever worked for an organization that had a union. And so they don't know a great deal about it. And I think that when it's something you don't really know much about, you tend to shy away from it. And I still think, though, the point that we made in the post today was that despite all the issues that we've talked about with organized labor, it serves a purpose, and it still exists for exactly the same reason it did 100 years ago. That's that management and labor just cannot figure out a good way to talk to each other. And in some industries, they need it. And actually, if people in offices that work at computer companies knew that it would at least they would have some ability to talk to their boss before they got fired, they might say, well, yeah, it might be worth it to have that kind of interaction. Maybe we could figure out a way around this. But I think people have just gotten so used to the fact that there is no discussion in most companies, which is something that most managers love, I think. But
well, Rob, let me ask you this. I mean, one of the things that led to the rise of the unions, I think, originally was you know, abuses by the management of companies, and so the workers kind of, you know, rose up against some pretty significant abuses. Sometimes economic abuses, sometimes physical. It doesn't feel to me like the same kind of conditions exist today.
No, I don't think. Well, hopefully, I don't think it's physical abuse anymore. I think we've pretty much gotten past what the textile workers or the meat packers or those kinds of people experienced 100 and some years ago. But again, I think it's more the discussion. I mean, if you look at here, great example. Happened with the DHL buyout, that they sent all the traffic to UPS. I mean, they had a contract. They had a working agreement in which both sides said, okay, maybe we're not all getting everything we want, but here's the way we're going to work together, because we both care about the same thing, which is the prosperity of the company. From management side, because they'll be able to promote a successful company to shareholders and potential investors, and from employees, because they know they'll have a fairly stable work environment. And then one day, management just said, you know what, guys? This isn't working for us anymore, so we're just going to give all this stuff to UPS, and we're going to get rid of you airplanes and pilots, and you all have a nice day. And then they say, well, no, why would these people be upset? And I guess, you know, again, is it physical abuse? Oh, no, certainly not. But you have to ask yourself, what goes through the minds of those people? What were they offered at DHL to say, well, we'll just kick our employees that have worked hard for us, flying beat up old airplanes for, you know, in the middle of the night all over the world, and we'll make them realize how absolutely little we ever really cared about them, because we stand to make a significant sum of cash for ourselves, and we'll just do that. And that's where, hopefully, or traditionally, collective bargaining has worked. But of course, in this case, this is an extreme. I mean, you want to talk about a topic that we ought to be talking about, boy, that is, as far as labor relations, that's an ugly one. And ALPA is really, really struggling with how to cope with that situation.
Right. I mean, we've seen what happens when it's purely management, no unions, right? I mean, that's the entire reason that unions were brought about during the coal mine strikes and, you know, Pinkerton and you know, that whole mess that was when unions first came out. It seems that, you know, like you guys were both alluding to, you know, we haven't seen that again. You know, this isn't so much a safety issue and people, you know, being owned by the company store and things like that. But there is a fluctuation of power between management and the unions. And, you know, we've seen times where management has had the upper hand over the union which ironically is usually because they're financially in such poor shape that they're able to push, you know, different changes in wage cuts on the unions, usually through the bankruptcy process. On the flip side, we've also seen where the unions have been in a powerful position and able to kind of extend a little bit beyond maybe what was economically feasible because the unions have been in a position, or more specifically, because, you know, what are elected union leaders to do when there's nothing to do? You know, they can't sit back and say, you know what, things are pretty good.
Well, and that's a really good point. Let's face it. And what is the purpose of any organization, whether it's a business, an association, a union? It's to survive. And when people are at the survival point, you're right. I mean, or when they're bored. I mean, let's be serious. And I certainly am not naive enough to sit here and say, well, you know, unions are the answer to everything, because they certainly are not. I prefer the balance perspective, I guess. And when you're working with a company that, and I don't, I you know, honestly, I've been on the management side too, and I never understood how some of those people thought. Where they would say, well, look, we're just going to do this. And I'd say, well, you know, you'll get, you know, as a PR guy, I'd say, well, you know, you need some buy-in from these people. You'll be much more successful if you can get these people to understand what you're doing and why you're doing it. They might actually help. They might have some ideas that, but honestly, some of the people I've worked with, just, it's a power thing.
On both sides.
Oh yeah, it is on both. You're right.
And, you know, coming from a union environment where I was involved in a pilot union to the management side, where I'm involved in the management side, you know, for different companies. But I got to say, I was shocked, you know, to find out when I kind of made that transition that these two groups of people have no idea what the other group even wants. There's a huge gap in communication between labor and management. Plus, you have the egos that come into play on both sides. It really is kind of disappointing to be a part of and see the lack of communication, I guess is a better term for it, that is between the two groups. I call for reform.
Well, you know, it's funny that you say that, though, Court, because, you know, I was interviewed for a story a couple of weeks ago when that GlennTilton.com website went up at United that the pilots put together that said, you know, let's axe our CEO. And I'm assuming that they meant get rid of him and not necessarily chop off his head, although maybe to the pilots at this point, maybe they're one of the same. But it was really interesting because person that interviewed me said, well, gee, Rob, so what do you think the solution is? And I said, well, here's a wacky idea. I said, how about a bunch of town hall meetings in some major United hub or base cities, of which there aren't that many anymore, and the board of directors, not just the CEO, but the entire board of directors goes out there and has a town hall meeting and just listens to what people have to say. And don't even bring the union people into it. Let them sit there in the back row on their hands. They don't even get a chance to talk because everybody knows what they think anyway. So just let the plain old baggage handlers and the fuelers and the airplane cleaners and the flight attendants just get up and stand up on a mic and tell the people that run the company what they think and why. Now, and you buy everybody lunch because food's always a great draw. Whenever you feed people, they're even more involved in the conversation. And I said, now imagine what that would cost United. Let's see, they'd be out the price of a lunch. They'd be out the price of airfare to send the board of directors around. Of course, that's free anyway. And who knows what they might hear. Maybe they'll do five of these and say, well, see, we didn't learn a darn thing. Or maybe they might learn something, but they don't. They would not even consider that possibility because they don't consider that anyone that's not management could possibly have anything to say that could be of any value to a decision that they make. And like you, Court, I swear, I'm sorry, I will never understand how people can be so narrow-minded. I mean, especially when you have at stake a huge corporation like this that has a long history, but also has a long history of really bad labor relations.
Well, speaking of big companies, I think on the September 3rd is the IAM vote on the Boeing contract. And, you know, if you look at the issues that remain, there, it kind of gives you an indicator of what are the tough points in these kind of relations these days. I mean, it's benefits, medical benefits, and it's pension.
And see, Max, this is why I like having you as the co-host, because you always keep me on track.
I know.
Because this is our last story, and I never really had a chance to get to it because it was such a fascinating discussion. But this from Bloomberg.com, and the Boeing union reviewing final offer line by line. Boeing presented the IAM and... let's see, the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers, I guess that's the IAMAW, with a final offer yesterday that would increase base pay by 11% over 3 years. Workers would also get a $2,500 payment if they approved the proposal by September 3rd, plus other bonuses. The plan would preserve the way Chicago-based Boeing uses contractors, rejecting changes the IAM sought and has said it would be willing to strike. Rejecting changes the IAM sought and has said it would be willing to strike over. The final proposal provides raises of 5% the first year and 3% the following 2 years. The combined 11% raise would be the biggest since the one of the same amount in 1999. The union was seeking an increase at the top end of the 9% to 13% 3 year range it's won recently for other aerospace companies, including Textron's Cessna unit a year ago. Terms also include a 14% boost in pension payments, additional cost of living raises each year, a bonus of 6% of gross wages or $2,500, whichever is greater, and the extra $2,500 if the deal is accepted in a first vote that takes place on or before September 3rd. These are some very significant raises that Boeing is offering here, and I see exactly what they're doing. And Rob, you can tell me whether or not you agree with this, but it seems like Boeing is throwing out, opening their checkbook, making this deal look as great as possible with these big numbers. We will even give you a check for $2,500 up to $5,000 if you sign before September 3rd. Oh, and by the way, we still need to be able to use those contractors.
And the fun part is being a PR guy on the union side saying, okay, how do we spin this one? Because it does look very, very good. And it is going to be tough for the union to say no to that. But again, I think it's going to really depend. I don't know enough about the financial status of the union and in this particular case, but they've traditionally been very, very strong with Boeing. But again, I guess they have to decide where this is this contractor issue going to be that camel's nose under the tent again that's going to come back to haunt them a few years down the line. I remember 15, 18 years ago when United started trying to contract things out and people were mildly upset. But now if you look at so many of the services that are going on at an airline, a lot of it is not airline employees. And they get them for a lot less money and they can ask them to do things that they can't get their union employees to do. So again, is this worth the fight to the union people, because they know they're going to get some really, really ugly publicity if they try to ignore this contract, because that's what the Boeing is going to do, is say, look at how generous we are being with these people, and we just want to do a couple contractors, you know.
Well, yeah, and let's face it. I mean, this is the devil's in the details in this. I mean, you know, it says that it would preserve the way that Boeing was able to use contractors, but what exactly does that mean? Because in effect, the higher your salary goes for your union workers, if you're preserving the way that you're able to use contractors, that just puts you in a very poor position, because suddenly it's all that much more beneficial to Boeing to contract everything out.
And that's precisely what the union is going to be sitting there thinking about right now. Money or no money, it's, are they going to draw a line in the sand? And that's what unions do, is that they try to push back. They try to maintain a balance, as fair or unfair as it may appear from either side. Again, the question is always, what would it be like if they weren't there at all? The company would just say, hey, guys, guess what? We're getting rid of half the workforce, and now we're contracting out because we figured out a way to bring in people from China to do the work for half the price. you would have nothing to say about it.
And I can almost see the union's argument to this, which, you know, you kind of brought up and we kind of discussed, but I really kind of side with the union on this. I mean, the more you're able to pay your employees without any real job protection, just puts you that much closer to being laid off and being outsourced. So I would not be surprised, as lucrative as this looks, I would not be surprised if this doesn't pass. It all depends on the union's ability to communicate that to its labor group. Now, again, this is all dependent on exactly what's in the details, what kind of job protection they have in this offer. But it's clear that Boeing is trying to kind of buy their way out of this contract with a very lucrative offer that may just kind of accelerate the pace of outsourcing.
Well, but you know, the one issue we haven't talked about here in terms of outsourcing that is always a factor in any industry is the quality of the result. I mean, if you build, little electric motors, and you can find the same motor in China for one-tenth the price, most people would say, well, that sounds like a great deal. But is that motor going to be as good? Will it last as long? Will it generate less heat? Will it be as efficient? And that's the kind of detail that they often don't look at. And people will say, well, who cares? Burns out in a year, then you buy another one. So it's great. Who cares? But there are those qualitative issues too that I think are often the result, which is somewhat what the Boeing people what the union people are thinking, although it's not their primary motive, isn't. Again, it's survival.
Well, on outsourcing, I mean, there's business motivation as well. I mean, if you know, Boeing may consider buying motors and other components from China because at the same time, and just hypothetically, Boeing is looking to sell aircraft in China. And, countries are increasingly looking for, their own economic benefit as a result of these deals. You know, we'll buy your aircraft, but you got to give us a piece of the pie. We got to participate in the manufacture of components for it.
You know, that's a great point. I mean, that's exactly what Eads and Airbus did with
exactly.
The tanker deal in
right.
Alabama.
It's a global industry, and to my way of thinking, the political borders, the boundaries defined by countries make increasingly less significant. And if the workforce is sort of motivated by different things, there's a collision of these two perspectives. You keep everything in country and close to home, or do you become a global manufacturing operation because it has a positive impact on your business?
Yeah. Oh no, I think that's a very good point that you made. And again, it's like any other business. It's a balance. How much are we willing to give up in order to get something else? Because very often when you fix or you solve one problem, you create another one. It's just a matter of whether people are aware of what they're getting into before they start.
Well, I'll tell you what, we could probably go on with this topic for hours. Maybe we need to have Rob on again.
Holy smokes, you guys are good.
But we are kind of running out of time. We've pushed this quite a bit, but seeing as it's Labor Day, that's quite all right. I do want to move into the pick of the week. And Max, I understand you've got a good one this week.
Yes. You're probably familiar with AirNav. Maybe both of you have used AirNav in the past for information. Well,
certainly.
It's a great resource, and it can be made even a little more convenient with a sort of Firefox add-in that I discovered. What this does is, it's not really a plug-in, although sometimes people call it that. It's similar to a plug-in, but it's a little bit different. What you can do is get this at mycroft.mozdevelop.org or something close to that. mozdev.org. And what this does is it adds AirNav airport info for pilots to the drop-down list of search engines in the Firefox browser. If you don't use Firefox, you should probably take a look at it and use it at least part of the time. But this makes it very handy because all you have to do is type in the airport identifier into that Firefox search bar. And what it does is it goes out and it gives you the airnav.com page that has information about that airport location, the operations, communications information, nav aids, services, you know, hotels that are in the area. Just a whole slew of information. So if you're a pilot or just an enthusiast who's interested in an easy, quick way to get a lot of information about a particular airport, this is a great way to do it.
So then I can put Firefox. I have to get Firefox in my iPhone, and then I can get that AirNav plugin.
I don't know if you can get Firefox for your iPhone at this point in time. And of course, it's not a plugin that works with Safari. So you may be out of luck with your iPhone, but for your laptop or desktop, where you can run Firefox easily, no problem.
Good. Moving into some emails, we did get an email. We actually got this last week, so I apologize. This is from Seth Carpel. We had to cut it out last week because I screwed up some of the audio and you couldn't hear it. So I apologize. This is a week late, Seth. But Seth is responding to one of the trivia questions that we had in the earlier podcasts. And he's from Orlando. And if you remember, the question was, how did Orlando, or what did the identifier for Orlando International, which is MCO, where did that come from? And, of course, the answer was that it was McCoy Air Force Base. But Seth kind of adds another little tidbit to that, and that is something that we had not thought of, and that is that MCO stands for Mickey's Corporate Office.
Ooh, very clever, that's Seth. Good.
Which I have to admit, I'm very surprised I had not heard that before. So thanks, Seth, for sending that to us. You win the grand prize, which Max and I discussed earlier, is our respect. Congratulations, until we can get a better prize. And we do have a trivia question for you this week based around the Labor Day theme. What we wanted to go with was something throughout the history of ALPA, the Airline Pilots Association, and Rob really helped us come up with this one. And the question is, in what year did ALPA sign its first airline contract? And for the bonus question, what airline was that with? So you can send your answers to thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. Or if you prefer to leave a message on our voicemail, 812-757-4252. So again, the question is, in what year did ALPA sign its first airline contract and with whom?
Wow. They'd have my respect, too.
Yeah.
I'd be impressed, yeah.
A three-way.
That's a whole lot of respect.
Yeah.
So again, Rob, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, this is always so much fun to have these discussions with you guys. I really enjoy it, and I hope we have an opportunity to do it again. And thanks for hosting this whole thing. And the best part about this is that, who knows, there's probably some person in Tokyo or Sydney or Brazil that's listening to us right now because you guys took the time to organize this, so I hope everybody's very appreciative. I know I am.
Well, that's why we do it, so that we get a chance to talk about airplanes.
Which it's kind of a geek thing, right?
Oh, wow, absolutely. Well, that's right.
We do invite everybody to email us, send us comments, suggestions, anything you have about the show. Really, you can't hurt our feelings. Send that again. It's the geeks at airplanegeeks.com. Don't forget we have the website, airplanegeeks.com. And vote for us on Dig, Podcast Alley. Write us a review on iTunes. Anything you can do to kind of get the word out about us. And, of course, the best way is to just tell your friends about us. We really do appreciate that.
No, I think we're about ready to put a fork in it.
I think we are. This one's done. So, again, Rob, thank you so much for joining us.
Happy Labor Day to everyone. Barbecue ad hoc.
That does it for episode 13. Thank you all for listening. Thank you, Max, and thank you, Rob, for joining us. And other than that, we will talk to you next week on Airplane Geeks.
See you soon.
Bye, everybody.